But my sister did a choir in middle school, and they had a, you know, those little boxes with chocolate in them that you have to sell.
Oh my gosh.
All I knew at the time was there was more candy in the house. And since I was the baby of, there was four of us, it was a dog eat dog world. So I locked myself in the restroom and I ate a whole bunch of her candies. And remember my dad told me, he's like, oh, Darryl, nothing in this world just comes for free. Like you have to pay for this. So my dad ended up paying for it, but I paid for it because I had a punishment. But that's my first money memory, because I was like, you can't just have things for free. So
it's like a trauma. Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of the Framework Podcast. I'm your host, Ana Trujillo-Limon, and I'm joined by my co-host, Odero Aisweni. Odero, thank you for joining me today.
Absolutely. Excited to be here.
Yeah, so we are here at FP's annual conference in Phoenix, and we're joined by someone who lives here in the town, so you can give us some good recommendations, Bridget Grimes. Bridget, welcome to Framework.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We're so excited to be here. The conference hall looks great. The vibe is good. And so we love this conference, and so it's awesome. So, Bridget, we always kick off the show with asking you, like, give us a 30-second for people who don't know who you are, who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I have a financial planning firm, and we specialize, called Wealth Choice. We specialize in helping women attorney partners, women executives, business owners, and women in tech with ongoing financial planning and investment management.
Awesome.
And we are virtual, so our folks are all over the country. I live here in Scottsdale, Arizona, but have an office in California.
Okay.
I also have another company that I share with a business partner called Equita Financial Network.
Okay.
And Equita is a platform for women-led financial planning firms. Total goal was, how do we empower more women to run their own firms, build their firm the way they want, have the quality of life that they want, get paid what they're worth.
Oh, that's really cool. And we're going to get into that later in the show. But we also... One of the most fun questions, because everything is so different for all our guests, is, what was your first money memory?
So, really great question. I was 8, and I grew up in New Jersey, and the deal in my family was, if you wanted allowance, any sort of spending money, you earned it yourself. Mm-hmm. And I had a paper route when I was 8, and I remember I bought myself this awesome purple bike and had a basket, and I would deliver the newspaper from my bike.
Sounds like in the movies.
I know. It's the olden days, you guys. I don't even think people read the newspaper anymore. But so I remember this winter, and it was like this icy road, and I'm schlepping my bike down the road. And it was the day that I collected the fees. And it was the day I got tipped. And I remember going to this one house. And, you know, you're freezing. You're dragging the bike and the newspapers. And I remember getting... doing the collection from this one woman, and she didn't tip me. And I just remember thinking, man, I am working so hard, and the purpose of the work is to generate the money, and it doesn't always work out that way. It didn't deter me, but it's something that just sticks in my head after so many years.
Yeah.
And I think it's part of my motivation, right? Mm.
It's a valuable business lesson.
Oh, yeah. Out of curiosity, did your bike have a little bell on it?
It did.
Okay.
It totally did.
The little
bling
bling?
Okay. Yeah, it did. And I had a banana seat with these big old 1970s flowers on it. It was great.
Those are the seats that should come back, because the little seats, they don't, they're not comfortable.
Oh, no. This had a lot going on.
You need some ergonomic support on the bikes, and those banana seats, super ergonomic. Love it. So, Darryl, I'm curious about your first money memory.
Oh, I always tell people my first money memory, oh, my sister's going to be so mad at this, but my sister did a choir in middle school, and they had a, you know, those little boxes with chocolate in them that you have to sell?
Oh, my gosh.
All I knew at the time was there was more candy in the house. And since I was the baby of, there was four of us, it was a dog eat dog world. So, I locked myself in the restroom, and I ate a whole bunch of her candies. I remember my dad told me, he's like, oh, Darryl, nothing in this world just comes for free. Like, you have to pay for this. So my dad ended up paying for it. But I paid for it because I had a punishment. But that's my first money memory, because I was like, you can't just have things for free. So
it's like a trauma. There was the first time there was ever a vending machine in my whole town. Like, this isn't just, like, I come from a little small town. My mom was in charge of stocking it. So she had this stockpile of all this is junk food. She never allowed junk food in the house. So I was just like, so I have similar story where I took those like snowballs, you know, they're pink and they have coconut and I ate them and I was like, this is delightful because it was like a, I'm eating junk food
hidden
in my
fruit.
Own house,
yeah, you know forbidden fruit.
Anyways, so talking about big purchases, Adaro, what was your first big purchase?
My first big purchase. Oh, that's, I would say my first big purchase was, yes, it was my DJ board.
Oh, okay.
So in college, whenever I got my refund check for summer school, thank you, Salome. Yeah.
You're still paying that off.
To this day, yeah. I went and bought a DJ board because I had actually just got out of a breakup. Mm-hmm. So I was like, this will be a good way to like find something to do to take my mind off of it. So that was the first like real pricey thing that I actually had to buy.
Yeah.
That was mine. What about you?
So I think when I was a kid and I was in middle school, maybe ninth grade, I bought a guitar. So my girlfriend and I, we had a band.
Oh.
And
what was the name of the band?
We didn't have a name.
Okay. Oh,
okay.
She played the piano. No, we did not make it that far. This was like a short-lived band. But I bought myself this gorgeous brown Gibson electric guitar and an amp. And I was so proud of that. And I was super sure we were going to hit it big. And we so were lousy. But anyway, that was – I'd saved for a long time. And I just remember being so proud of that.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know what happened to it. So –
do you remember like the emotion that it evoked whenever you purchased?
Yeah, because you did that yourself, right? You made that happen. Mm-hmm. And you know, I have great parents, but they instilled in us like you want something, you work for it.
Yeah.
And that was okay. Like that's how we grew up. And so I wanted this. We had a guitar store in my little town in New Jersey, and I just remember that was the one. You just made it happen. And it was great.
I love it. We've always talked about having a framework band, you know, back in the day. Jamie played bass and, you know, I play the keyboards. Mm-hmm. And, do you play an instrument? Well, you could DJ.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, actually, my first instrument was guitar, but I was bad at it.
So. Okay. Yeah, it was very good.
All right. So we have Bridget now on guitar. That's awesome. Right? That's awesome. So, Bridget, tell us about your journey into the profession.
Sure. So I actually started on Wall Street in 1987, which is a very long time ago. And I was picked up by a hedge fund. I was the only woman, super young, right in my 20s, on this trading desk. And I loved the whole vibe of Wall Street. I, you know, worked in Lower Manhattan. But I really did not like trading, which was essentially what we did. So I did that for a bunch of years, and left the industry, segued into, strangely enough, cooking. Because at night in Manhattan, I would go to cooking class for, like, my therapy. Hmm. And wound up cooking professionally for a decade. And then it was a personal deal. I got divorced. And when I was getting divorced, I had two little kids. And my closest friends were also getting divorced. And these were all women doing really well professionally. You know, one was a surgeon. One ran a media company. I was doing great. And I realized that none of us had a plan. And interestingly enough, it was, I read this article in the Wall Street Journal. It was a woman who had graduated from the same college as me, Eleanor Blaney.
Oh.
And she was talking about addressing some of the alums from our college, like deer in the headlights, super smart women, very accomplished, but none of them knew anything about money. And I could totally relate because I was like, here I am. I had never paid a bill, even though, you know, look, I had been on Wall Street for years. Mm. But I was too busy, so my, you know, now ex-husband was the guy who paid the bills. Mm-hmm. And we had debt. We got divorced, and I was like, how is that even possible? We don't have debt. We had three country clubs. You know, we had living the dream. But I decided then and there that was never going to happen. I was going to engage, and I was going to work with women like me. Yeah. And that's really when I came back into the industry. Hmm. Started at a wirehouse, realized that that wasn't the best model for me. And really started working with women attorneys who have very similar challenges to women in finance. Mm-hmm. You know, pay disparity, marginalized because of gender, really hard issues with balance and work and life. And so I just started to help women who I knew I could help because I could relate.
Yeah.
And then over the course of years left, went to an RIA, was part of a women's group where we, my client base was women execs. And then 7 years ago, I launched my own practice, Wealth Choice.
Okay. That's wow. That's what a journey. That's amazing. And yeah. Eleanor Blaney, you know, that's, I think we owe a great debt to, you know, you and Eleanor and the women who came before who kind of paved the way in this profession. So it's really awesome. Mm-hmm. So one question that we didn't go over before that I'm curious about is, since we are here at FPA, we're the official coaching partner of FPA. And I'm curious about your journey into this organization and how you've gotten involved with them.
Into FPA?
Mm-hmm.
So I actually am the co-host of the Women's Knowledge Circle, which is great, right? Our whole focus is to help bring women together in our industry and share best practices, education, and community. Mm-hmm. I think I've been involved in FPA for ages, as far back as I can think, probably when I left the Wirehouse, and they had a great local chapter in San Diego where I was working. Mm-hmm. And just over time, I've just been as engaged as I could be.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's an awesome organization.
Yeah.
Love what it's doing.
Part of being a great fiduciary is helping your clients understand their full financial picture, and it should be no different for your life. Do you know what your business is worth? Get your firm valuation today with our free valuation calculator. Whether you're looking to share equity with your team, buy another firm, prepare for an exit, or just simply want to see the market value of your business, visit carsongroup.com/valuation to get started.
Yeah, so you mentioned that you worked in the food industry for some time. Out of curiosity, did you know the term mise en place?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you wanna,
I'm good at that.
Okay.
Yeah. Can y'all explain to me?
Actually, yeah. If you translate that from French, it means to put in place.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And mise en place is when you have your menu, your recipe,
mm-hmm.
and you know exactly what's involved, and you get it all ready ahead of time. It's putting everything in place so that when you get cooking, you just cook.
Yeah. So the reason why I brought that up, well, a couple of reasons. One, I think a lot of people talk about, you know, in people's developmental years, it's really important for them to work in either the food industry or like a service industry, because you grow a lot of personal or interpersonal skills. Mm-hmm. So I worked at Chipotle in college, and that was a really good experience because, one, I learned how to cook, mm-hmm. but also it taught me how to plan, because mm-hmm. I had to set a lot of things in place, and I didn't know that people had to wake up like at 5 a.m. to start like prepping for the day.
Oh, yeah.
So what did you learn from the food industry to where you are now running your Equitif? So am I saying it correctly? Financial Equita. Network?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And you know what? That is a great question, because if I think back, cooking is, you have to be crazy organized, because when mm-hmm. service starts, you just have to get it done. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, when you manage your way through cooking, you navigate over years, you start super junior and you work your way up to chef. Mm-hmm. And you could never be a chef if you had not been junior, mm-hmm. because you don't realize all of those steps. You learn to be crazy organized. You really learn to plan. You cannot cook mm-hmm. and just, you know, for a restaurant and just wing it.
Yeah.
It's impossible. You've already figured out your menu. You know what you're serving. You know how many covers you're going to have. You know how much you need to order for those, you know, meals that you're going to create.
Mm-hmm.
There is a tremendous amount of planning. And, you know, it's interesting, because years ago when I lived in Manhattan, I knew a woman who had worked at a Wirehouse and had left and launched a restaurant. And I thought, oh, that's so random. Like, how do you? But then when I did the same thing, I left and I cooked, I was like, oh, now I got it, right? So, I would say that being in that industry really teaches you to prepare. And it absolutely translates into financial planning, right? Because that's what I do. I plan. I am really good at helping somebody figure out what's the plan and how do we execute it.
Oh, yeah. No, I would say that the best talent that I got from Chipotle was, by the time I had left, I could slice 20 pounds of onions and I wouldn't even shed a tear.
Like, super fast, right? Super
oh,
fast.
Really fast.
Iron eyes. Yeah.
Iron eyes.
Yeah, iron eyes.
Bridget, do you still cook, like, for fun? Like,
I do. You know, it's funny. I was a pastry chef, and I worked at some really great restaurants, and I have these children, and all they wanted was banana bread. And it was so frustrating. I was like, I can make you anything. Like, and it's going to look really good. And they're like, Mom, all we want is banana bread. So now my kids are old. I would send it to them in college. I was like, I'm going to just make this as long as you're going to take it. And now, honestly, it's funny. I when you get to my age in life, like, you don't eat a lot of dessert. So I love savory food. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I can, after work every day, because I have an office in my house, I go upstairs and I cook every day, and we have a really nice dinner.
Oh, it's really fun.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So I'm curious about, you know, you have your own firm. You've had your own firm for many years. And for a long time, you were adamant about not hiring employees and mm-hmm. just doing it all yourself. But not technically, because that's how where Equita comes in, right? But you brought on your daughter to into the firm. Let's talk about how that's going and that decision and how it's going.
So we're at the early innings.
Talk to you again next year. We'll schedule it out.
We're going to do follow up. My practice, I'm essentially a solo, mm-hmm. and I have 68 families I work for, breadwinner women, really busy people, and I pride myself on really deep, rich planning, super communicative. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. And I have outsourced everything else in my life besides the financial planning part. But you get to this place, and it's really funny because when I launched my firm, I remember this woman I was working with who coaches people in our industry said, "So Bridget, when you get to 35 million of assets under management, you're going to need to bring somebody in." Well, 35 came and went, and I'm at 80. And I finally was like, oh my gosh, like I would love to take a vacation and not be stressed mm-hmm. Because that doesn't happen. Yeah. So when I looked at my business and what I wanted for it, which was really just to continue to do great work for my clients, mm-hmm. I knew that I needed help. And I was really against W-2 because I love my model. I love how simple it is, right? Everybody in my world is a 1099. And at the end of the day, you know, a few years ago, I started talking to my daughter who's 26 and in a finance role at a tech firm. Mm-hmm. And she's doing great. But I just said, you know, I think that this would be something you would love. What she doesn't have in her role is working with people. Mm-hmm. And she is probably the nicest person you'll ever meet. She is smart. She's beautiful. She's nice. And I just thought this would be so great to bring her in because I think she'll thrive in this. Mm-hmm. So over the last couple of years, she took all the CFP work. She still works, mm-hmm. but she starts with us on January 1st. So right now.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Gotcha. And I think it's going to be a great fit. And so when you look at most people say, oh, so she's your successor, right? She's your succession plan. I have no plans to stop work. Mm-hmm. My father's 86 and he runs a company. And so, but he runs it where he has these people, right, who allow him to take time for himself. Mm-hmm. And so my goal with bringing her on is ultimately there probably will be some level of succession. Mm-hmm. Right now it's to create, you know, build her up as a great financial planner mm-hmm. and have another set of eyes for clients and just add to their experience and allow us to do deeper work. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because right now it's very hard to do that with the amount of clients I have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So out of... It's really cool hearing you talk about your journey starting in the industry, working on Wall Street. And you said, what, 1986, correct?
1986.
Okay. So considering how the industry has changed and you talking to your daughter about, hey, I think you would really enjoy mm-hmm. what you do. How do you think the tide will change for, you know, the Gen Z or this next generation that's stepping into finance? Do you think we'll see more individuals turning towards the financial planning industry?
You know, I hope so. It's a great industry for anybody, but it's especially great for women. Now, the challenge, as I'm sure you know, is that, you know, if you're an employee in this industry, there's still a challenge with balance of work and life. Mm-hmm. There is. Most of these firms expect you to be in there and work all the time. And if you have children, it's really, I never saw my kids, right? So when I worked for an RIA, the deal was you work. And then when you're, you know, you work the 9-to-5 job and you do events in the evening and then, you know, you see your family later. And that's not going to keep women in this industry. Hmm. It's not. Now, Carson did a great study on this and I have to tell you, awesome points. But the thing is, we have to take the points and we have to execute on them. Right. So the way I look at this is for women, younger women like my daughter. This is a great industry. You have to find the place that will allow you that balance, that will reward you for the work and that will pay you what you're worth. And that is where this industry has to get better. Now, I think we have to have mentors. So I have a peer of mine, Carrie Carbonara, and I, we've launched a mastermind group and we're going to help to come up with a, you know, free mentoring program. More on this later. For women in the industry, doesn't matter what your, you know, subscription fee only, we don't care. Mm-hmm. But there are no mentors for women and that has to change. So when I look at my daughter, she's going to have the fortune of being able to work in a firm where we have that balance, right? Mm-hmm. I created it because I needed that myself. You know, not every woman who comes in the industry is going to have that. So I think that this is where the industry can do much better because we want these people, we want women to stay. Because what we see now is women come and women go and the numbers stay the same and we get no further.
Yesterday I moderated a panel of entrepreneurs who had started their own firm and had a similar sentiment in that I felt like I had to build my own lane because so I could live the way I wanted to live. And what I'm seeing is more of that happening. And I think it would be beautiful to see like those kinds of firms consolidate and have the bigger, you know, resources that the bigger firms have and stuff. But all of that was wonderful. But what mentors have been really vital to your success that and why?
So I'm going to be really honest. I've never had a mentor.
Really?
No. I haven't, and that's
why
not
you're
good.
So passionate about
that's
it.
That's why I'm so passionate, because like that's not good.
I had to find all this stuff out
No. Right? So, I mean, I've done coaching, and the coaching has been really critical to my life and my business. Critical. And I am here to tell you, my business would not have grown the way it has and in the way it has if I hadn't had the coaching, because I had no other access to, you know, when you're a solo, you're just doing your thing. And you don't know there's another way to do it. So I actually engaged with Limitless a couple years ago. And it was pivotal. Not only to be a community of, you know, there were 100 other people doing what I was doing and we would, you know, be in those meetings. But to really have somebody say, hey, there's another way to do this. You know, you need to carve out time for yourself or it's unsustainable and just different, best practices that you didn't even know existed. But I think a really key part of this, when you talk about the mentors that I didn't have, is community. It's community of other advisors who are like you, who can share and support each other. And that's actually why I launched Equita, because it doesn't exist. And if it existed, I wouldn't have had to do it with my friend, my business partner. But I think if you don't have a mentor, if you haven't had that experience by coming together in a community, wherever your tribe is, whoever you gel with, I think that helps you succeed. It truly does. I don't think any of us can really succeed without community.
Absolutely. I'm a big believer in community too, because it helps like you move through the hardships and
this
industry is not easy. So you move through together, you know, and I love that. But you brought up Equita. So let's talk about that. Like, give us the backstory and how that's going.
Sure. So when I launched my practice 7 years ago, 7 years and a week, I knew how I wanted to serve clients, but I was so afraid of making mistakes on the business side, you know, compliance, E&O, all of that. And I was just kind of paralyzed. So I found a company where I would pay, you know, a percent of AUM, and they would provide me the custodians and the compliance, and pretty much that was it. And so, like a year into my business, I realized that what I was paying for was not the level of resources that I would like. You know, if I was going to build this firm, it was going to have the very best resources possible, but how do I get that? So, you know, fast forward to a girlfriend of mine on the East Coast, has her own, you know, solo firm as well. And we said, hey, let's join together, right? Economies of scale. Let's find all these awesome resources. We'll share the cost and we'll build this platform for ourselves. And we started to talk to other women solos out there, you know, hey, what would you want to see on this platform? Because we're going to do this once and we want to do it right. And what was really interesting is that overwhelmingly women said, I would love to know that there was a community of other women like me because you are super lonely out there. I mean, we're doing what we love, but you're really alone when you run a firm yourself. So we spent a year doing due diligence on every component of that platform, and we put it together for our own firms, and we just decided, you know, we're just going to make it available to other women. And women, so it's for fee-only solos, right? Some of the people on our platform have grown where they have a bunch of W-2 employees now. But it still provides the community and the resources that these women need to build the business they want, right? And like I said earlier, this is about how do you have a practice that you want on your terms, you serve who you want, you have the balance in your life, and you get paid what you're worth. And that's different for everybody. So the way I've built Wealth Choice, my planning firm, is very different from how anybody else on that platform is choosing to build their practice. And that's the point. You do you, and you know, I'm going to build mine my way. But we're going to share along the way, you know, things that will help each other succeed. And it's been, the sharing part has been really awesome because I'll tell you, I wouldn't have known how to hire an employee. Even though it's my daughter, there's a lot involved in a W-2 employee. And even saying, hey, I think that this is the right step for my firm. And, you know, it could be as simple as, hey, how would you solve this estate planning problem? And knowing that one of the women on our platform was in trust and estates for 20 years. So being able to share our own unique expertise and our passions, and I'll tell you, COVID was brutal for these women, right? Many of them have children. Now they're homeschooling a kid or two. They're running a company, and they're trying to live some quality of life. And by having people, you can really, you know, peers, you can leverage and say, man, how are you doing this? The community aspect has been awesome.
Yeah, knowledge sharing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Bridget, out of, I do want to ask a question, but I gotta give some context in advance.
Sure.
So I would say one of the most impactful things in my career, not just career, life, has been mentors or people who have just helped. I'm the baby of the family, so I naturally was born into mentors. I really didn't have a choice. But whenever I started at my first firm, now I refer to her as like my vet because that's what NBA players say. Her name was Emily Jackson. Her name is Emily Jackson. And she taught me so much about the work life as far as just, hey, there's some mornings that you got to wake up at 7 and just get after it, you know, or like these are different ways that you should interact with your managers. So what would you say to some of the people who are in places of, you know, middle management or upper management who don't feel that they're in a place to actually mentor other people? What would you say to those women specifically in the industry to like actually reach out and take the initiative to mentor?
So you know, I guess it's a level of introspection, right? Like, do I, and this goes back to that imposter syndrome. I think a lot of women especially feel like, who am I to guide you, right? And do I really have enough expertise to be able to share that with somebody? And I would challenge anyone who felt that way that, you know, yes, you do have that. Because, you know, I've got 4 kids. And it's interesting because, you know, we talk about their jobs. They're all gainfully employed, which is great. But, you know, sometimes they have crummy employment experiences, and we talk through that because that's a win, right? Mm-hmm. You may be leaving that employer, but you took something away from that experience that you're going to use moving forward. So, you know, anyone who may think that they're not in a place to help, I would challenge that. And I would tell you that everybody has something to share. They may not realize it, but they do.
So considering the fact that you are a mentor to us and other people out there, what would you say are some of the biggest hurdles that you experienced in starting your own business? And what's some advice that you would give to others out there?
Sure. So one was thinking that you could do everything yourself. I was terrible at delegating. And it got to the point where, you know, you're working 24/7. So one of the things that I learned from a peer who I saw, you know, finding people in all these places to help take off the load from her plate. I learned that delegating is actually a really good thing and has helped me grow a lot. And even though you think you can do it better, you can't do it better. So you find great resources and you delegate. I would say carving out personal time was really important. I'm very bad at that. But when I got coaching, which is my next thing, so coaching is a non-starter. Like, you have to do the coaching. So with my daughter, I've already got her a coach because I never had a coach. And it was so terrific because, like I said, it was all of these things you never knew yourself that was even, you know, were even out there and different ways to do things. So the coaching was really critical, and that coaching helped me carve out personal time. And it really helped me change not only the business, but then my own family life. So coaching, personal time, delegating. I think for me, having a niche is critical. And I would say to anyone, you know, you could probably serve anybody, but you would serve a specific niche, somebody for whom you're truly passionate best. So my niche was easy because I wanted to serve women like me. And I think that that's made a difference because when I serve my clients and they're breadwinner women, I know what they're going through because I go through it myself or I've been through it myself. And it's very easy to help these folks with solutions when you can relate. So I would say absolutely focus on a niche and stay true to it. So I get my business is referral only at this time, which is awesome. But sometimes folks aren't the right fit for my firm.
Yeah.
And so I have a great group of other planners that I can refer them to. And I learned by making the mistake that taking on a client who is not your niche is a bad idea.
Yeah.
All right. It's not the right person.
Could you expound on that?
Sure. So, a couple years ago, I had I posted a women's group for over a decade, and a woman who'd been coming to my women's group. So she's the fit, right? She's a woman attorney. Makes sense. She engages with me, and then she says, "Hey, can you bring on my husband?" And normally, you want that. You want to have both people in a relationship, so you're not providing planning advice in a vacuum. It's really comprehensive. So I said, of course, let's do it. But we had these conversations in the beginning, and I got the feeling like this was going to be interesting from the investment perspective, because he was very investment forward, kind of a stock picker kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And even though he's not in our industry, he really felt like he was an expert in
those
space.
Are my favorite type of clients.
Knows far more than we do, right? And so I kind of got that, ooh, I don't know. But I took him anyway. And COVID hit, and the market got wonky. And he was like, "Bridget, I want to sell everything, and I want to buy these, Amazon, Zoom, Microsoft, the big tech stocks." Mm-hmm. And I was not okay with that. And I said, "That's not how we do it. I hear you. You could carve some of it out and, have at it. But, if I'm providing you guidance that's supposed to help you get to your goals, I don't believe that that's in your best interest. Mm-hmm. And we don't do that here." And he said, "Well, and I said, "I'll tell you what, I'm going to work for the next quarter and I'm not going to charge you." And, you're talking about an $8 million client. So I have costs here, but mm-hmm. I made this crazy decision, and I, spur of the moment, I was like, "I can't lose this guy. I'm just going to cut my fee." And I was talking to my coach, and she's like, "Bridget, you never cut your fee." And I said, "Oh, but I can't have the guy leave." And so we did like these triage calls, and she's like, "You have a value. Don't do it." And I did it anyway. So the quarter comes and goes. The guy hasn't paid me. Everything's good. And I said, "Okay, so, Jeff, we're going to move forward." And he's like, "You know what? We're not going to do that. I'm going to leave." So I...
After all that,
I said to my coach, "You were totally right. And I had this value, and we provide this ongoing value. And everybody in our industry needs to believe that you provide this value. And if a client is like, 'Hey, I'm not paying for it,' that's great. Have at it." Or they don't align with the way we work and our values. We need to be strong enough to say, "Okay, that's okay. I'm going to help you move to a place that you're more comfortable with, but we are not a fit."
Yeah.
And it was such a, it was a crummy experience. And the whole time during the year, you're on pins and needles. Is this going to work out? Is the guy going to stay? When it should never have been a client in the first place.
Yeah. So that speaks to the importance of having your values and your mission, right? But also the importance of listening to your gut, too.
It does. And, like I said, my clients are the specific niche of breadwinner women. And, the spouse, the woman was like, "Bridget, I am so sorry, but, I need to go with him." It was wild. But it was also a really good learning experience. And, I think at the end of the day, you're as good as your values, right? We know we have a value. Rule number one, never cut your fee.
Yeah. Yep. Well, thanks for sharing that story and being authentic with us. But we want to be mindful of your time. And these are pretty short and sweet and wonderful conversations. So I've enjoyed chatting with you both today at FPA. And so we always end with our signature question, which is, what does the term finding your freedom mean to you?
That's a great question. I think for me, it's living life on your terms, however you define it.
That's beautiful.
That's good.
I think we're going to have a little booklet with all of the answers to that question.
Because be awesome.
You should.
Awesome. Yeah, you heard it here on Framework. I'm going to work on it. We'll get it done. But thank you, Bridget, so much for your time today. Thank you, Odaro, for joining us today. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to this episode of Framework. Please don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.